The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. This is our monthly episode 4, where we get to ask our speaker all the questions that we've gotten from our episodes for the month so far. And by the way, thanks for all your questions and feedback. The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child, first and always. Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. This is Paul Workus back again with Steve Kelly, who is kind enough to have joined us again to answer our questions about otorhinolaryngology. How'd I do with that?
Excellent.
Trip off the tongue, otorhinolaryngology.
Yeah, try it in Spanish. It's even better.
Oh, what does it sound like in Spanish?
Otorhinolaryngología.
I'm not going to try it.
Yeah.
All right. Do you have any disclosures that you'd like to share with us?
No disclosures, Paul.
All right. I think you got to get some disclosures, Steve. I will start hunting for disclosures for you. How's that?
All right. That sounds good.
I think you need some complication in your life right now. We have a couple of interesting questions. It turns out the question sort of, you know, went afield from our topics, but, you know, when you have an otorhinolaryngologist on the line, you take advantage of that. So let's just dive right in. Here's the first question. Do you use oxymetazoline, trade name Afrin, for any conditions? If so, how and when? And I think one of them actually comes up later in the questions.
Yeah, we use it all the time, actually. It's very helpful for us. So in the clinic setting, we'll use it for, you know, to decongest a nose. It's a good vasoconstrictor, and so it'll shrink the turbinates down pretty quickly. So when we do a nasal endoscopy in the clinic, when we do a flexible laryngoscopy, flexible nasal endoscopy, rigid scopes, we'll use it almost all the time to get a little decongestion of the nose so that we can slide the scope in a little easier and see things. We use it to help with epistaxis, good vasoconstrictor, so we'll use it acutely in the epistaxis setting. We'll use it in the operating room a lot. In nasal surgery, we do it to get hemostasis as well as vasoconstriction and decongestion in the nose in sinus surgery so we can see better. Occasionally, we'll use it if we have a little excess bleeding from a tonsil bed or an adenoid bed, put it on a tonsil sponge to get a little extra hemostasis. We'll use it occasionally in ear surgery, or not occasionally, fairly frequently in some of our ear surgery to get some hemostasis as well. So very common for us to use it. For patients to use, we don't like them using it a lot chronically. So it's fine for them to use an acute sinus situation, maybe for 3 or 4 days, but then to be off of it. Sometimes we'll have patients that have trouble with eustachian tube dysfunction, and they'll have a lot of ear pain or sinus pressure when they fly or, you know, when they're changing elevations, et cetera. So I think occasionally in those situations, we'll have them use some Afrin before they fly or before they know they're going up skiing. If they tend to have a lot of troubles equalizing pressure in those situations, that can be helpful too. So we use it in a lot of different situations.
It sounds like there may be some clinical settings where we may benefit from teaching people to use it very sparingly and acutely.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Excellent. Sort of a similar question. Question number 2, is there a benefit to having kids do sinus rinses? How and when do you recommend them? And is there a way to talk kids through that?
Yeah, I mean, I think they are helpful. You have a kiddo that has a chronic snotty nose. I think having them do regular sinus rinses, even if it's with nasal saline spray versus, you know, like a neti pod or a Neil Med rinse, those are higher flow systems. And so those are often very difficult to get younger children to accept. But many of the younger children will accept nasal saline spray. They can do 3 or 4 sprays in each side of the nose 3 or 4 times a day. That can be very helpful. In our patients with chronic sinusitis, sometimes we'll have them do daily or twice daily saline irrigations. It's very important in our patients that have, say, acute complications of sinusitis, orbital cellulitis, or intracranial complications. We will definitely do saline rinses in those patients. we'll use Afrin in those patients as well for better sinus drainage.
So two follow-up questions occur to me there. One is, when you describe doing a sinus rinse with a nasal saline spray, you say you squirt in four or five sprays. Do you suction it out then, or you just let it let nature take its course?
So often we'll tell parents just to let it take its course. Kids are, a lot of them are fairly accepting of the saline spray, for instance, but they're not terribly accepting of the suctioning, either bulb suction or a catheter suction, et cetera. They seem to be more accepting of the spray versus the suctioning part. So what I will tell parents is to use the spray if they seem to have a lot of obvious nasal discharge and it's helpful to suction, that suctioning is fine to do. Suctioning sometimes can be a little bit of a double-edged sword in that it can cause some congestion in and of itself.
Second question that I'm asking for your indulgence for a follow-up on that one too. You mentioned using saline spray in somebody who has things like chronic sinusitis and that sort of thing. Is there a role for nasal steroids in those settings?
Absolutely, yeah. We use a lot of nasal steroids, both in our chronic sinusitis patients, as well as in patients with allergic rhinitis or turbinate hypertrophy. They can be very helpful in those patients. They're not as helpful in the acute setting because they take a little while to work. Usually we have patients use them even for several weeks regularly to build the levels up in the lining of the nose before we kind of give up on them. So they take pretty regular use and a little bit more prolonged use than many people often prescribe before we kind of throw in the towel on them.
And my follow-up question is, in your experience, how helpful is a humidifier?
I think humidifiers can be very helpful in many situations. For instance, in patients that tend to have chronic sinusitis, they can be helpful. The key is that if you're using humidifiers, you need to make sure the humidifiers are clean and that we're not introducing fungus or these types of things in those settings. So they can be helpful in patients with chronic sinus troubles. They can be very helpful in patients with croup, with bacterial tracheitis suspicion. We like a lot of humidity in those patients. Sometimes we've even had battles in the hospital of getting the respiratory therapist to let us use humidification in some of those patients, which, I don't know, that's one of my pet peeves, but we sometimes lose the battle.
Yeah. And definitely here in the winter desert, there is a humidity shortfall. It helps to make up at least part of that.
Yes, there is.
Next question. Let's talk about nosebleeds. What do you do when people come in with concerns about nosebleeds? And it seems to me that the question is sort of getting at two categories. One is somebody comes in with a nosebleed that won't stop, and those guys often end up in the emergency department and seeing you guys. Let's start with questions about people who say, you know, she has a lot of nosebleeds. Where do you go with that?
Well, we like to know how frequently they are occurring, how long the bleeding lasts. We want to know if there's a history of other easy bleeding or bruising or family history of bleeding problems. Those are good questions to start with. The side that it's bleeding from, is it unilateral or bilateral? Any instigating factors, what causes them? Does the child pick at their nose a lot?
In my experience, people always deny their child ever picks their nose, and I beg to differ.
Yeah, I think they deny it a lot, but a lot of them will admit to it when you ask them directly. Even some of the kids will admit to it, right? But yeah, I think they deny it a lot. So those are things that we want to kind of focus on. And then, you know, we want to know, are they using anything in the nose that might help them? Do they use saline sprays in the nose, which I think are limited value long term as far as increasing the moisture content in the nose? I think that there are certainly some new saline gels that are made specifically for the nose that can be helpful, that have a lower petroleum content than Vaseline, certainly, that we get patients to use a couple times a day. And we solve a lot of their problems just with doing some of the topical gels now.
I know there are case reports of Vaseline ending up in the lungs from the nose. Do you worry about using Vaseline in the nose?
Yeah, we don't really like it in the nose because of the lung issue, but also it can do some similar things in the nose with the higher petroleum content. So we don't prefer to use it in the nose at this point. You know, there's some commercially prepared nasal saline gels, they call them, Air, AYR produces one, Ocean does another. And, you know, you put a little on a Q-tip going about a centimeter and just paint a little bit in there a couple times a day. And those are quite effective. They're not as thick as the Vaseline. Many of the patients, even if they were using Vaseline, they complain about it's too thick and they can't breathe after they use it. The saline gels are much better for that.
I'm always fascinated to ask people what they do when their child has a nosebleed, because you hear a lot of weird stuff. I mean, I can't tell you how many people pinch the bony part of the nose, or how many people just put a cold compress on the back of their child's head and have them blow their nose occasionally. I mean, just all sorts of stuff like that. It seems like, you know, in the world of Boy Scouts and first aid, that a direct pressure is not a bad thing.
Yeah, direct pressure to the soft tissue of the nose, to the nostril area, is effective. You don't want to have them, you want them more in a sitting position, leaning forward, not tipping their head back where it's all going down their throat. Continuous pressure for 5 to 10 minutes can be quite effective. Sometimes if you have some Afrin handy, you can squirt that into the nose. You can put Afrin on some cotton pledgets, put them into the nose, not far enough back where you can't get them back. But most nosebleeds are anterior, what we call anterior nosebleeds, which come from the most commonly from the front part of the nasal septum, Kieselbach plexus area, where there's a lot of superficial vessels there that either are susceptible to trauma from nose picking or just, you know, dry mucosa that cracks open and bleeds. So that's where most of the bleeding is coming from. And so doing the pinching of the nostrils for, you know, 5 to 10 continuous minutes often can resolve it.
Do kids who are having repeated nosebleeds do better very often with cautery? Do you do cautery under those circumstances?
The times that we will do cautery would be sometimes in the acute setting. If we can, you know, if the patient comes to the ER, they have an acute persistent nosebleed and we are able to identify an anterior vessel, or sometimes even in the OR, we can identify a posterior vessel that's bleeding and control it. We'll do cautery in that situation. With the kids that have the chronic nosebleeds, often if they'll do topical therapy, that'll often solve the problem. But if they're continuing to have epistaxis despite good topical therapy with saline gels and other things, then we would consider cautery. Sometimes you'll look in the nose and you may see some prominent, often you'll see prominent vessels in Kieselbach plexus, and often you'll see maybe a crust. You can tell likely where they've been bleeding from. Sometimes you'll see some ulceration of the nasal septal mucosa. And in that situation, we'll use some mupirocin or Bactroban ointment in the nose, you know, twice a day for 10 days to try to heal the mucosal ulceration. And if we can get the mucosa to heal, then often the nosebleed will resolve as well.
So a reference somewhere to you guys using glue in the nose. Does that happen?
Well, not glue. There's a product called FloSeal, which is I guess it's kind of a glue. We would inject it, squirt it through a syringe into the nose.
Gotcha.
It's kind of an anterior pack that's an absorbable anterior packing.
And there are going to be some kids who have an intractable nosebleed, and those are the kids who end up getting you guys seeing and packing and all that sort of stuff, right?
Right. Those would be kids that have, you know, acute nosebleeds, severe nosebleeds we see in the ER. We also will see, you know, some of our kids that maybe in the bone marrow unit that have thrombocytopenia or other reasons to have thrombocytopenia or underlying bleeding disorder that may have some acute nosebleeds that can be difficult to control.
Excellent. Are nosebleeds a contraindication to using nasal steroids?
They can be, though certainly one complication of nasal steroids can be epistaxis. In my experience, that's usually because the nasal steroid is being sprayed toward the septum instead of the lateral nasal wall. So if we can get patients to, when they spray the nasal steroid sprays, aim toward the lateral nasal wall, out toward the cheekbone, we'll tell them, then we seem to have much less problem with epistaxis. You know, it's either trauma from the nasal steroid on the nasal septal mucosa or just the inhaler itself irritating the septum that, yeah, you can see some epistaxis.
It seems to me that's a less sensitive part of the nose as well. It probably feels better to squirt it that direction.
The septum is very sensitive. Everything's much less irritating on the lateral nasal wall than the septum.
Perfect. Last question. Talk to me about deviated septum. When I look up a child's nose and see a deviated septum, when is it a significant problem? Which kids need to see you and which kids need to have it fixed?
If you look at everyone's septum, if you look at everyone's external nose, you'll see a lot of deviations, right? So sometimes that can be from trauma. Sometimes the nose just grows that way. So just because there's some deviation of the septum doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to even be a problem or doesn't necessarily need to be fixed. So it really depends on the degree of nasal obstruction that the patient's experiencing. Some people have fairly deviated septum, but have never noticed that they have any difficulty breathing through the nose. Some people even have mild deviation of the septum, but tend to have a lot more trouble. Part of it's the septum, is how much the septum is deviated. Part of it is where the septum's deviated and maybe how narrow the nasal valve area is. Even a mild septal deviation can be obstructive, especially if they have a narrow nose to begin with. So addressing it surgically really is based on symptoms. We try to wait until a child is older in general. There's some evidence in the literature that early nasal septal surgery or aggressive septal surgery in younger kids may affect the growth overall of their nose. So we try to delay that if we can until they're older in the mid to later teenage years, if possible. But there are some kids that are so severely deviated and obstructed that we may do it sooner.
So it sounds like this is one of, as with many issues we've talked about, that we ought to pay attention to function and symptoms more than structure. Seeing big tonsils doesn't mean I have to do something about it. Seeing a deviated septum doesn't mean I have to do something about it.
Correct. I think it's really based on symptoms. Now, there's some deviated septums can sometimes contribute to epistaxis as well by changing airflow through the nose. If it's severely deviated, because of the change in airflow, you'll dry out the mucosa and may have trouble with epistaxis because of that too. So there's a variety of reasons to consider correcting a deviated septum, but in general, we try to wait till they're a little bit older before we jump into that.
Excellent. Well, Steve, thank you so much for your time this month. This has been very helpful. I've heard nice things from people who've been listening, and we really appreciate your time. We appreciate your expertise. We appreciate you taking good care of the kids we sent up there.
You're welcome. Thank you, Paul, for the opportunity.
All right. For our listeners, please remember to like and subscribe because, again, as always, we're very needy. And if you have questions, if you have suggestions for topics, please send us an email. We're always happy to try to figure it out. Thanks again for listening. We'll talk to you later.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.